Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Steve Silver Show on Blog Talk Radio.
What is up? It's 3 o'clock, the Steve Silver Show here on Blog Talk Radio, brought to you in part by FanDuel.com. Steve Silver, along with Bo Reed from Let'sTalkRangers.com. Bo, good afternoon. What the hell is up, my friend?
Well, you know, just living in a world. Is it baseball season yet?
It is, actually. It is baseball season. It is. We flash forward. It is now March. We are knee-deep into spring training. Your Rangers are still, you know, four pitchers shy of a full load. The Mariners are set to hoist the 2015 AL West banner. The Astros got better. Yeah. How did I get four? I don't know. I just, you know, I'm shooting off the cuff, man. You know how it is.
I mean, I'd give you two, but four?
No. Well, it is 2015, Bo, and you know we are on the cusp of another baseball season. What lies ahead for you and Let's Talk Rangers this year? Are we going to get into some prospect talk this year on the website? Are you going to use the platform to pump up the inevitable third place finish? I mean, what's going to happen this year on LTR?
Well, you know, we're going to start getting into some prospects. I certainly, especially as we get into spring training, guys to look forward to maybe crack that 25-man roster that most of the fan base probably doesn't think is going to crack that 25-man. So we're going to look into that, look into what the Rangers still have to do this offseason, because it is still technically offseason. We haven't started playing catch in Arizona yet. So we'll look into that a little bit. And as we get into the season, we'll probably start projecting out, seeing what this Rangers team can and can't do in 2015. And then before you know it, it's going to be draft time. The Rangers have a high draft pick this year.
So we're
going to amp up our draft coverage a little more than we have in the past. So it's going to be a good year on letstalkrangers.com.
That's a good deal, man. And for all those baseball geeks out there that are looking for some good Mariners talk, you can always head over to the website, marinersnation.blogspot.com. Interesting article, Bo, that I'm about to put out for all you arm injury geeks that are trying to scratch the surface of why there's so many, you know, damn arm injuries in Major League Baseball. It's interesting, Bo, because we know a lot about what the medical world has come full circle when it comes to Tommy John injuries. We understand the UCL ligament, it's a complete tear, and they go in there, they graft out a new ligament, and all that is good.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't know really is about labrum tears, rotator cuff injuries, and some of these type of things. What we do know is that at certain points, there is, you know, you can have good recovery and good success from it, depending on, a pitcher's wherewithal to change his mechanics, stuff like that. So, you know, and the reason why this came to fruition is because the Mariners have a pitcher, a former number one pick that's slated to apparently be healthy, ready for spring training, by the name of Danny Holton. You know Danny Holton. And so it's kind of weird, Bo, because you know how I work, man. My inner nerd just kind of whirls. And, of course, you know, my work on, you know, the Hot Stove Report on 1090thefan.com. Being around other baseball minds and other nerds, it just fuels my psychosis. So unfortunately, you know, that was my week. Talking to medical experts, talking to orthopedic surgeons about rotator cuff injuries, about torn labrums, and I can tell you definitively, Bo, that you can't. That's the crazy thing about injuries, Bo. You can't put a percentage. You can't handicap injuries. It's not like you can't say that 99.9% of all rotator cuff injuries happen to bad mechanics. You know what I mean? But
right. What
you can say, though, is more oftentimes than not, if you do speak to medical experts, they will tell you that the more oftentimes than not, they will see a guy who has a blown-out labrum, it was due to poor mechanics.
Yeah.
You know, you can say that, but you can't put a percentage on it. It was a very interesting conversation, Bo. So definitely look out for that as well, too, for all those baseball nerds out there, all that good stuff. That was a hell of an intro to the show, right?
We just
completely diverted the entire circumference of what we're even trying to do today. And we just got into just some straight nerd stuff right there. How about that? So anyways, we do have a good show today. We are going to dive into a little bit about college football, the college football playoff national championship. Ohio State on paper looked like they'd completely destroyed and undressed the Oregon Ducks. But we're going to dive in a little bit deeper, Bo, because I think you and I both agree on this, that I don't necessarily think that it was completely – all Ohio State, as it was maybe Oregon, was missing some pieces. I don't want to make a, I don't want to be an excuse maker for the Pac-12, because obviously, you know, that's where my heart and soul lives. And of course I was pulling for the Oregon Ducks, so I don't want to get into the whole excuses making, but when you're missing seven key components on offense and you put your quarterback on an island, there's only so much that he can do. But that's not to take away from credit of Ohio State, because Bo, they played a picture perfect game on defense and they really kept Marcus Mariota neutralized. So we're definitely going to get into that. Obviously it is championship weekend in the NFL. And of course my Seattle Seahawks will take on the Bo's hated Green Bay Packers as the Packers tread west to the house of pain that is CenturyLink Field. So we're going to get into that. Also, the Indianapolis Colts, not the Denver Broncos, and we will get into the Broncos as well too. They travel out to Foxborough to take on the Pats as the AFC Championship will get underway as well too. Obviously, the winners, Bo, will meet up in the this year's Super Bowl in Arizona, which most likely will be in New England and Seattle. So we'll definitely get into that. We'll also get into some major league wherewithal. And as a matter of fact, we'll probably do that in just a second, Bo. So, yeah, it looks like a good show today, Bo.
Well, it's always a good show when you can talk about a college football championship, you talk about championship football in the NFL, and you throw in a little baseball. That's always a good show.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can't do a show without talking about baseball, am I correct? I mean, we personally cannot do that.
I think if we did that the entire like fabric of the universe would just explode.
Right. Right. You're actually my walls will come crumbling down if I don't talk at least some baseball. But we span the globe, Bo. Let's span the globe.
Let's span it.
Spanning the globe to bring you the constant variety of sport, the thrill of victory, and the agony of defeat.
I can't help it, Bo. Topic number one comes from Las Vegas, Nevada, as the boxing. Bo, yes, we're talking boxing.
It's about time.
Headline number one, because word out of Manny Pacquiao's corner is that he has agreed to all concessions that Floyd Mayweather Jr. has put forth. He will split all revenue 60-40. That includes all pay-per-view. That includes everything 60-40. He has agreed to Olympic-style drug testing. He basically wants the biggest piece of Floyd Mayweather Jr. And so now, Bo, this is all on Floyd Mayweather Jr., who, by the way, has said that he does want to fight Manny Pacquiao. But I guess the question I have for you, Bo, are you buying this? Are you finally buying this? Will the world get to see the fight that we've been waiting for like at least 10 years?
I sure hope so. You know, it's it's at the point with these two where every time you hear this rumor, yeah, it's going to happen. It's going to fight that, you know, it's quickly done away with. This seems a little bit more legit. I will give it that. But until the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, and they have their big weigh-in showdown face-to-face, maybe a couple punches thrown there, until that happens, I'm not buying it.
I'm going to buy it, and I will say this, because you know what? Good for Manny Pacquiao for agreeing to all the concessions, because really this was Floyd Mayweather Jr., in my opinion, basically flapping at the gums, basically saying, listen, you know, I'm going to need this. And Manny Pacquiao said, okay, no worries. What, 60-40? Cool. I mean, I got enough money anyway, so what's another $40 million to me? You know, okay, cool, no worries. You want drug testing? All right, cool, no problem. Let's go do this. Let's do this. I think Manny Pacquiao understands something, Bo, that Floyd Mayweather Jr. doesn't. Nobody wants to see these two fight anybody except for each other now. At this point in time, As a matter of fact, I was looking at some numbers today, and what's interesting about this is the numbers are down across the board on pay-per-view buys. Nobody's buying either of these fights. Nobody wants to see these guys fight anybody except for each other. And right. I think now Floyd Mayweather Jr. understands that. He understands it and understands that, listen, my career may not be lasting that long. I mean, the guy is 37 years old at this point. This is going to be it. This is really what the sport has come to. And what I absolutely hate about the sport of boxing is what I loved about Don King back in the 90s. It didn't matter what card you fought under, what promotion you fought under. If the thing, the visionary of Don King is lacking in boxing. If this happened in the 90s, this fight would already would have happened at least three times.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Because that's the thing is you bring two entities together for the good of the sum, which basically means if you put these fighters together, everybody makes money. And by the way, isn't what this sport is all about? Today, today there's no visionary, and nobody wants to see these guys fight anybody but each other. So now it's all on Floyd Mayweather, and if he ducks this, though, because there's already this feeling that he's afraid of Manny Pacquiao.
Yeah, yeah. If he ducks it, he's done.
He's done.
He is done.
If you fight him, Bo, and he loses, okay, that's fine. But at least you fought him.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to tarnish his legacy if he loses. But if you duck him,
he's done.
Yeah, you're done. You're cooked. You're booked.
I tell you what, though. I mean, I don't know if you've heard about this, but this is what's really exciting me about boxing. Because as you know, as I've said many times, I am a very much traditional boxing fan.
I am too.
I do not like the UFC because it's essentially killed boxing because all the talent's now going to the UFC side, which is part of the reason why I don't watch it. I'm a little excited about what NBC is going to start doing this summer. I'm really excited about that.
I will say, Obo.
Maybe we can have a renaissance of traditional boxing in this country.
I haven't bought a pay-per-view fight since Tyson was relevant. Put it that way. That's how long it's been since I've seen a boxing match. I'm not talking about when two white guys box at 3 in the morning on ESPN2. I'm not talking about that. And by the way, that's when you know you've come home entirely way too late from the bars, when you come home and you see two white guys boxing on ESPN. Anyway, I digress.
I also enjoy that fight, too.
I seem to continue to watch those fights until I fall asleep on the couch. Anyway, This fight, if this actually goes down on Cinco de Mayo, if this goes down, I'm buying it. I already told the wife, we're buying this fight. And she was like, she looked at me and you know what she said, Bo? No doubt. No doubt. She's fine. She was fired up. That's when the wife gets fired up for a fight, that's when you know the world is good in your world. That's when you know everything is good in the world.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, I'll be right there with you. Not only do I have a pay-per-view fight at my house, I'm going to have a party to go with it.
That would be pretty fun. A party? Maybe a flight out to Baltimore is actually in my future. Anyway, headline number two comes from Oakland, California. Bo, everybody's favorite baseball GM, Billy Bean, my GM man crush, I got one, has pulled off a trade today, sending Yuniel Escobar, the guy that he acquired along with Ben Zobrist, traded him to the Washington Nationals for Tyler Clippard. Your thoughts, Bo?
It's a good trade.
Great trade.
It's a great trade.
Great trade.
Beyond that, I said this 6 weeks ago after the winter meetings when Bean just decided to trade everybody.
Right.
And I said, I said it then. I'm gonna say it now because it's still kind of relevant. It's he's one or two moves away from all of this making sense.
Right, it's like the Gary Busey theorem where you basically say you're about two steps away from spinning yourself completely off the planet. What's kind of funny about this is when Josh Donaldson was traded, a lot of people said, "Well, this team is pretty much rebuilding," and I kind of understood what people were saying, and I was leaning toward that a little bit, but when you look at everything in totality and you see their pitching staff, how it's really kind of intact, and they got two guys coming back from Tommy John surgery a little bit later this season, and they probably could use a couple more starters in that rotation, but they just added Tyler Clippard, who by the way is a very 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 good setup guy, and now you put him into a bullpen that was already really good.
yeah
Like they can shorten the game to like the sixth inning. Like this is like I think that's really the point of this trade was, I think Bean understands a couple of things. That number one, he doesn't really have a true ace anymore because he lost John Lester via free agency, traded Jeff Samardzija to the White Sox, and really what he has is Sonny Gray, who's pretty good. I don't think you and I would consider Sonny Gray a starter. But what he does have is Sonny Gray at the top of the rotation, and he also has Scott Kazmir. And then really what's kind of after that is kind of, it looked better with Lester. It looked a lot better with Lester and Samardzija. But what he has right now, and as soon as the nerd, there it is. Okay, so as soon as the nerd machine fires up, basically what he has is Sonny Gray and Scott Kazmir at the top of the rotation, though. That's okay. And then he has Jesse Chavez, Jesse Hahn, Drew Pomeranz, and Kendall Graveman. But he also has Griffin and Parker coming back a little bit later. But for the most part, this is what it is, man. So I will say, Tyler Clippard coming in and adding it to Ryan Cook and Fernando Abad and Dan Otero and some of these other guys, it shortens up the game by another inning. And when you look at from 3 to 5, maybe you like Drew Pomeranz, I don't know. But from 3 to 5, basically what they're telling us, it's not necessarily telling them that you're crappy. It's not telling Jesse Hahn that he's crappy. It's just, like, listen, if we have it, we have the bullpen to stretch this from the 6th inning on. So if you can give us 5 1/3, if you can give us 5 2/3, cool, we have the bullpen to win this game. That's what it's saying.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, when you've got a back in the rotation that, I mean, let's be honest, there's some question marks in there.
Yeah.
No matter how good your bullpen is, you can't burn it out by June. And that's where the A's are going to have to be cautious.
True. But, you know, what I really like about this was I just like the savvy of what Billy Bean did. I mean, this was great.
It's Billy Bean, man.
Well, because in order to get Ben Zobrist, he had to take on Yunil Escobar. The thing that he really liked was Marcus Semien anyways. I think the idea was Marcus Semien was going to be the starting shortstop anyway. So Yunil Escobar comes in, and then as soon as he, like, you know, just kind of wipes his feet and says hi to everybody, he's off to Washington, D.C. Now, the thing about this isn't necessarily, you know, the shortstop situation in Oakland. That's kind of clear with Semien. It's the shortstop situation now in D.C. Now that Yunil Escobar is in the fold, now what happens to Ian Desmond? He's a free agent to be, and they've been trying to shop Ian Desmond all offseason.
Yeah.
Now what do you do if you're Washington? I mean, because what's kind of funny is Washington's kind of asking a lot for Ian Desmond. They can't move him yet. This is not a good situation for the Washington Nationals.
No. They're not done. It's not right now, but I'm sure this is something that's going to get cleaned up. It'll all go out in the wash before spring training starts.
True.
I mean, the Nationals, I mean, it's not like their front office is filled with morons. I mean, they know what they have to do. And, you know, you may end up taking less of a package than what you're really wanting for Desmond, maybe even less than what he's worth now that teams recognize they have to move him. But he'll eventually get moved.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it could be worse. It could be Philadelphia where you have, you know,
Like I said,
Ruben Amaro Jr., which is basically, you know, it's what is Philly ruin tomorrow's future? That's what they call Ruben Amaro Jr. in Philadelphia. Ruin tomorrow's future.
It's like I just said, the Nationals don't have an office full of morons.
That's true. It could be worse. But
you could have Amaro in your front office.
What's crazy about this is if right now you ask me and if you pulled me today, now again, things could change because the Angels could actually get a credible second baseman and they could also figure out what they're going to do with Josh Hamilton and actually, you know, get another top of the rotation ace, and maybe I might have a different, you know, perspective in like 2 weeks. But right now, if you ask me just on balance. If you ask me what team has the best balance in this division right now in the American League West, I'd tell you the Seattle Mariners. I would put them first, and I would put the Oakland A's second on terms of balance. Now, I'm not saying the team with the best power or the best, you know, I'm talking about just the best balance between bullpen, starting rotation, defense, and lineup, I'd probably say the Mariners are the first. I'd probably say the A's are second. And then I would, and then it's a coin flip between the Rangers and the Angels at this moment, because I think both of those are kind of like 3A and 3B, and then of course the Astros, who by the way have quietly kind of crept into the balance conversation. Now I know that on paper, like when you look at their starting rotation, you see Scott Feldman is still anchoring that rotation. It kind of makes it sick a little bit. But for the most part, that team is not going to lose 100 games this year. So, I mean, balance-wise, I mean, there's still a lot more things to do, but, you know, we'll get into that. And headline number three, speaking of the Houston Astros, Bo, today they trade for Evan Gattis. They gave up a package that kind of was a head-scratcher if you think about it, because they gave up two off their top 10 list. And another very good pitcher. Quietly now over this last year, the Houston Astros, Bo, have given up a lot of starting pitching depth to some offense. And over that course, it was, to me, I wouldn't say that it was, I wasn't surprised, because to them it's worth it. And I think what we've seen from the Astros so far is they have their own system of how they do business down there in Houston. They have their own way of how they want to rebuild, and that's fine. A lot of people on the outside looking in kind of laugh at it a little bit. But for the most part, some of these young kids that are now at the major league level have started to bear a little fruit. So maybe there is a little bit more than meets the eye. Now you get Evan Gattis, who last year, I think he hit, 22 home runs last year for the Atlanta Braves. So you bring him over to play left field, and you add another power right-handed bat to that lineup. And now all of a sudden that lineup is starting to look a little bit decent. Your thoughts on the Evan Gattis trade today?
I think that Houston is doing things that they should have waited 2 years to do. I mean, look, if they were, say, a few players away and possibly contending, actually contending, Steve, not just, hey, we're not going to lose 100 games, actually contending in the American League West, if they were 2 year window of that, I'm okay with this trade. Okay,
right.
But and this is what was really the head scratcher about this, is Houston going up to the last calendar year was really track.
They played some good baseball last year.
They did, but they were also on track to finish off this rebuild in the 2 year window I just mentioned. Now you talk about all the trades they've made, dealing guys off the top 10 list that they should have never dealt in the first place. It's going to push that rebuild window back a bit.
I don't think it will, because I the one thing that I will say about the Houston Astros, and this is a very underrated quality, and this is something that a lot of people don't like about me, Bo, because they don't understand my logic and my thinking toward this. And of course, prospects, I always say this, man, prospects are meant to be traded at some point. Now, granted, some come up to the major league level and some produce. But at the end of the day, I think what Houston is trying to do at this point is, it's not just to avoid 100 losses, but I think when you look at this team, just take a step back and look at this team as a whole. Now, of course, you can sit there and say, yeah, they're not a few pieces away, and you probably will look at the starting rotation and kind of just point to that and be like, yep, there it is.
Mm-hmm.
But what I will say is, this team right now as is, after this Evan Gattis trade, looks to me like a 500 team, or at least coming close to 500. Last year, I think in the second half, they played incredibly good baseball, beat a lot of very good teams that were playoff caliber teams, some of them actually taking series against playoff teams that were in the playoffs. And that is a sign of a team that finally, as far as I'm concerned, it's a sign of a team that's starting to get it, and I kind of like that. And the thing that people don't like about this is, you're absolutely right. It's like, why would you trade this guy when you haven't even brought him up to major league level and seeing exactly what he can produce? Well, because maybe these guys are about a year away. In totality, maybe these guys are about a year.
All the more reason not to.
Right, and I understand that. But at the end of the day, here's the one thing that I always say. You can always draft more players, and if you're going to trade these guys, at least have an idea of what's behind them. And mm-hmm. I think what Houston has realized was, that's cool, because we actually have some guys that are behind them that possibly are on the exact same time frame as some of these guys, and they're also pushing the needle north as well too, from the same time frame of getting to the major league level. So from that point, you're not going to be missing much as far as depth goes, and we can also replace those guys in this upcoming draft. And of course, Houston's going to have a high pick as well too. So I will say that, yeah, of course, you don't want to give up some. You would like to see the Astros get a guy that's a little bit better than Evan Gattis for giving up two of your top 10 prospects. you would think that you want to get a guy that may be a little bit younger, that also has a little bit more control, and mm-hmm. And also is maybe a little bit, his star shines a little bit brighter than Gattis. But you know, for them, this made sense, and they feel that they're not going to lose a lot. The trading these three prospects, and they get a guy who is going to profile very well at Minute Maid Park. I mean, we're talking about a left right-handed pull hitter, and as we've seen in Houston, Bo, those guys have very good success hitting in that ballpark, poking it out to that short porch and left. If they bring him in and he hits .260 with 25 and 85, I would probably say that the trade is worth it, wouldn't you think? And the Houston Astros finish at least .500, and now all of a sudden what we thought was in that cycle, and all of a sudden they go into next season and add a little bit more and a little bit more. All of a sudden now this team could actually, this whole division can go from possibly a 2-team race to what we see right now, which could be a 4-team race, to this entire division being a very, like, from top to bottom, this division is going to be .500 or better.
Okay, that I'll give you that. I think that most of these teams in this division are going to at least flirt with .500, if not be better. But at the same time, you don't deal what they dealt to Atlanta just to get to .500.
Well, I mean,
you don't do that. I don't care.
This team has been terrible for the last 5 years. I mean, it's
just
bad. Last year it was just because Texas was decimated by injuries that they finished 3 games better than the Rangers. But for the most part, you know, this is a team that has either lost 100 games or 90 games for 5 consecutive seasons. And I can tell you that for the last two, it was because of the rebuild. And so now you're going into year three, and then going into year four, year five, you have to start making moves, because at the end of the day, and you can understand this from this perspective, Bo, because this is also a business. Baseball is also a business, and you have to sell. You have to be able to draw revenue. And the thing about rebuilds is that that's not sexy to fans that want to come out to see a losing product. They can withstand it for a short period of time because they understand what you're trying to do. But if you don't keep an eye on your Major League ball club, because at the end of the day, that is what's bringing in the money. You still have to be able to draw revenue. You have to be able to win enough where it keeps interest in Houston. And as we know, baseball in Houston for the last decade now, since they got to the 2005 World Series and lost to the Chicago White Sox, baseball in Houston has been irrelevant.
Yeah, but you have to also look at the circumstances at the beginning of this rebuild. They had nothing.
Right.
At the end of the Bagwell, BGO. They didn't trade them, so they didn't get anything for them.
I'll give you a good example.
That's a longer rebuild, though, Steve. It's going to be 6, 7. Now it's probably going to be 8 or 9 because they're the top prospects.
Let me tell you this, okay? The Houston Astros are profitable. Don't be fooled. Don't be fooled by the gimmicks of a small market owner who has a small market mentality. Everybody's profitable in baseball. This is just like what the Mariners. This is what the Mariners went through as well too, because of a series of bad trades involving prospects they shouldn't have traded, and also not trading players when they should have traded. The Mariners bottomed out as a franchise, and Jack Cerenzik, it was 2009, 2010, 11, 12, and 13, 4 years of rebuilding and drafting and purging payroll. And you know what? Safeco Field was a ghost town. In a town, by the way, that is actually a very good baseball town in Seattle.
Yeah.
And Houston's actually an underrated baseball town. And what's funny about this, but at a certain point in time, you have to be able to do something to draw fans back, because you know what? What's going to happen is if you don't have that revenue coming in, ownership is not going to take those necessary steps. And so you have to do something. And unfortunately, it means maybe it's a prospect that you didn't want to trade. Well, guess what? I mean, Evan Gattis, is he Robinson Cano? Well, of course not. He's not Robinson Cano.
No.
But at the end of the day, when you put him into this lineup that it is, now all of a sudden Houston actually looks like a team that's going to put fear in the heart of opposing pitchers, and that's the point. It draws some interest, and it's going to bring people to the park, and that's a part of the equation as well, too. So I get it from a business standpoint. I get it from a player standpoint. I get it from a fan standpoint. I get it, and from a Houston standpoint, I don't like the idea of their number two and number eight prospects going in a deal for a guy like Evan Gattis. I thought they probably could have got a better player.
Yeah.
But
I mean, if you're gonna deal guys like that, you better get somebody better than Gattis.
But also, let me
you better get a pitcher for your rotation. Let's try that.
But also, let's understand this one thing. And I know that there's people that are tuning in that are probably saying the exact same thing. Like maybe they disagree. But here's the biggest thing about this, Bo. And I know you can understand this. It's all about availability. Maybe Evan Gattis was the only guy the only right-handed power hitter that was available, because Justin Upton, gone. And maybe Houston wasn't ready at that point in time to make a deal for Upton, especially with 1 year left on his deal. Maybe Matt Kemp was too pricey for him and he wasn't available. Maybe Evan Gattis was actually just available. And so, you know what? That's the price you have to pay when you win. And I hate to use this term, because I don't like to pull references out. I know this is going to shoot right back into the 1996, Bo, and a little Jerry Maguire reference, but I'll tell you what, man, nobody said winning was cheap. Nobody said winning was cheap, and sometimes you have to pay a little bit more than the market price to get a guy to come, but that's the market price you have to pay, especially when you're in Houston or if you're in Seattle.
Well, look, we're on the same page there. All I'm saying is Houston did a move like this 2 years too soon. Maybe you could do it next year. Maybe. But you got to see how this group plays this year. They've got no pitching. You can add all the offense you want. You play in the American League West, you need pitching.
I think their bullpen got a little bit better this offseason.
Bullpen's a little bit better, and it could have been better.
Gregerson and Neshek are definitely going
to
prove
very
it.
Very good. You know, if they could have signed Miller the way they fought hard to sign Miller before he went to the Yankees. I mean, But let me ask you this. What's the asking price for Cole Hamels right now? What is it, two top 10 prospects?
Probably three, the way that, Ruben Amaro Jr.
Right. So in a real world,
Cole Hamels would probably cost a team two top 10 prospects, probably two mid-level prospects. In return, the Phillies would have to eat a little bit of that salary coming back.
Right.
But
yeah. But here's the deal.
Ruin tomorrow's future does.
Here's the deal though. If you're Houston and you're willing to trade a couple of top prospects, okay. Do you go out and get a Gattis who has what does he have left on his contract?
He's still
in arbitration years, right?
I think he's getting two arbitration years.
Two arbitration? Okay.
So he's got about at least three.
All right, so you get 3 years out of Gattis, or you could have made essentially the same trade, maybe toss in a couple more pieces. You get foot five or six out of Cole Hamels, and you actually improve a rotation. The lineup itself isn't a bad lineup with or without Gattis,
but that rotation is
terrible. If you're going to deal prospects like that, at least deal up for a guy that's going to give you a five-year window. At that point, somewhere in those 5 years, you're going to be a contender. Then you can follow guys like that.
It's all about availability, you have to understand, though, but Cole Hamels has a part of that negotiation that he had a no-trade clause, and I can probably guarantee you that he has to approve a trade, and I would probably think that is not a team that he would want to go to. I think he's a Southern California guy, so if
you're probably right there. But you see, but I think my bigger point is, at this stage of their rebuild, if you're going to deal that kind of a package, you've got to get a guy coming back that is for sure going to help you when you are a winning ball club. You give up that kind of prospects, you push that window back at least 2 years, that you make it 1 year of contention with Gattis before he cashes in on the free agent market.
Also, Evan Gattis, 2014, made $520,000 on a mm-hmm. one-year deal, so he's part of the major league minimum. Major league service, he has two full years in, so he still has four more years left before his actual free agency. So, yeah, he's got one more year till arbitration kicks in, and then three more years until free agency. So, this is actually not a bad deal when you consider he does indeed have at least 4 years of club control in a hitter-friendly park that does favor right-handed pull hitters. So I can, you know, I would that
I think you're a year early on this.
I think they were one prospect though a little too deep on that one. I think it could have been a 2-for-1. I think I would have been happy with a 2-for-1, but not a 3-for-1. Bo, that's gonna take care of the spanning the globe portion of the show. And of course, that was brought to you in part by FanDuel.com, the internet's only number one-week fantasy gaming spot, Bo. Check that out, FanDuel.com, for all you fantasy baseball geeks out there. I know for a fact I will not be playing this year because I just don't want to do that. Not a really good pub for a fantasy. I know. So that's the whole thing. Is I'm bad with those. I'm bad at repping fantasy sports sites because I'm not a fantasy guy anymore, Bo. I'm done. I'm done with fantasy sports. Anyway.
Do you have a bad year, Steve?
Football wise, yeah. It was pretty bad.
We all had a bad look. It was a weird fantasy year, man. We all had bad years. I don't know about you, but in my leagues, we had people winning leagues that had no business winning the league.
So
it was a weird year.
This is how my first round went. I had the number 10 pick, and I had how I had my mock draft went. I was expecting Drew Brees to go by pick number 8, the latest. I had him going between number 5 and number 6, and number 8, the latest. My pick was going to be Andrew Luck at number 10, and of course, Drew Brees falls to 10, so now I'm on the clock. What do I do? Do I take Drew Brees, who I know has historically been a fantasy stud? Last year he was a fantasy stud. There's no reason why not to think that he would not be a fantasy stud. Or do I take Andrew Luck? And, of course, I take Drew Brees, and he does not have a very good fantasy year.
That happens to all of us.
Henceforth, I did not have a very good fantasy year, and that is the nature of the beast. So
that happened to all of us, my friend. Trust me.
I'm still depressed over it. I got to be honest.
I would have taken Drew Brees in that spot.
Yeah, but it's Andrew Luck, and of course my kid. This is what's worse about it is my 14-year-old kid who was in the same league takes Andrew Luck, and he just went absolutely ape nuts with Andrew Luck this year, and beat me twice with Andrew Luck, and so that's
that'll sting.
That was like lemon juice in an open sore, Bo. So, we have a couple football games this week, Bo. I don't know if you know this. The world didn't end with the national championship, though. I mean,
football's still going on, eh?
Right. So apparently the Green Bay Packers are traveling to the House of Pain to take on the Seattle Seahawks, my Seattle Seahawks, in the NFC Championship. I think we both are in agreement here that this isn't going to be just the Seahawks win. It's going to be by how much. I think the matchup here is just terribly wrong for Green Bay just because of Aaron Rodgers' calf injury. It is noted that he's been held out of practice. It's progressively gotten worse because of that game. And this game, the Green Bay Packers, Aaron Rodgers is what I like to call ice cream for freaks in this nature, because the Seahawks defense is going to be so stifling. Not only is Aaron Rodgers not going to be able to have the same comfortability as he had against the Dallas Cowboys and find pockets and find areas where he can exploit it, because that's not going to be it. The thing that's going to have to happen for Green Bay in order for them to alleviate even just a little bit is Eddie Lacy is going to have to be able to run at least with some consistency against the Seahawks defense that just does not allow that to happen. And they bring so much, it's like waves of pressure that I just don't see a situation, especially with the calf injury. I just don't see a situation, Bo, where Green Bay is going to be able to come into Seattle. And, like, I would give Dallas a little bit better of an opportunity than I would coming into Seattle versus Green Bay. I think Dallas probably would have given them a little bit better of a game. Ultimately, I think they probably would have lost to the Seahawks. But I think this is going to be a situation where, I don't see the Packers even remotely coming close to scoring 17 points in this game, Bo.
Not against that defense. No, I mean, and you watch them in the divisional round. I mean, they did. You know, they got off to a good start, and then they closed well. But those middle quarters, the Cowboys' defense was able to really stymie the Packers offensively. And you really saw the impact of Rodgers having to stay in the pocket. He couldn't go outside because of that calf.
He could, what he did in the pocket was pretty phenomenal. I mean,
it was pretty phenomenal when he had time.
Considering the injury, and you know, he made some very tight window throws that only a dude like Aaron Rodgers can make. And because of it, the Packers were able to win. I mean, without him being able to do that, they don't win that game. I will say, though, the thing about this is the last time Green Bay came to Seattle, of course, Aaron Rodgers decided to avoid Richard Sherman. This time he's not going to be able to – he's not going to – excuse me. He's not going to have the luxury of doing that this time around.
No.
He's going to – you know, he's going to have to be able – he's going to have to work both sides of the field to be effective here. But the problem is, outside of Jordy Nelson, this is the problem that I have with Green Bay's offense, because you know what? To me, this offense is so one-dimensional. You kind of have an idea of what they're going to do before they're actually going to do it. And I think we saw last week against Dallas. Don't get me wrong, Aaron Rodgers was still able to do some things against Dallas's defense, and ultimately it was one of the reasons why they won. But I think Dallas had a very good game plan.
Mm-hmm.
Had a very good game plan defensively, where it's like, if we can just neutralize Jordy Nelson and make Aaron Rodgers go somewhere else, it's going to work out into our benefit. And they tried, and at points in time they succeeded, but Dallas's defense is not Seattle's defense, and Seattle won't just neutralize them. They'll try to take them out of the game plan, period.
Yeah.
And it will be the exact same thing we saw in week one. This, to me, is not going to be a contest, Bo. It is not a contest.
You know, I honestly think we're looking at, you know, we had a couple of blowouts early in the postseason. I remember Wild Card Week, in the first two games were blowouts. The game after, or the game before Dallas on Sunday, was a blowout. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just these teams aren't matched up well. But the one thing, you just hit it right there. They're facing a much, much better defense than they faced last week, and they barely won last week at home.
Defense
had no business even playing on the same field with that offense, yet was able to hold them to, 26 points?
Something about these NFL playoffs have rubbed me the wrong way. And I don't – something about these playoffs I just don't like. And I know that I'm kind of breaking off a little bit for some of these topics, Bo, but this is a very good opportunity to get into this conversation. And, of course, if you want to chime in, 714-816-4704 is the phone number. You can also hit us up on Twitter, at LTRReed or at InsiderSteve. The thing that drives me bonkers about these playoffs, there seems to be something that has diminished these playoffs, and maybe it's just because the NFL condones the actions of what we've seen against the Lions, Bo. You had the reversal of a correct call that completely took the wind out of the sails of the Lions that benefited Dallas. And then last week, it was the exact same thing. And it was a call that was basically to the T of how the rule is read. And what I don't like about it is it's completely hypocritical from what we saw just a week earlier, where The back judge, this is what I didn't like about this. It was because the back judge in that Dallas Lions game threw the correct flag, had the right call, and then they reversed it. And then the very next week, it almost seems hypocritical, because now all of a sudden they're throwing the flag and adhering to the strict letter of the law, where a week ago that wasn't applicable.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden it's very applicable to a play that was actually – you know, that actually took the Dallas Cowboys right out of the game.
Yeah.
And, well, and to me, Bo, this is what I don't like about this. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theory type of guy. You'll never hear me ever talking anything about an NFL conspiracy, because I really believe in my heart of hearts that the NFL will never job one of their own. And every single owner is one of their own. And I will have it on good authority that the NFL will never job one of their own. But what I will say is, this is a league that does condone these type of things, because they put so much money into marketing that anything can happen, even if the refs are the ones that are involved in what could happen. Mm-hmm. That's why they put so much money into parity, that they condone these type of things. If the NFL didn't want this to happen, not only would they actually have the correct rules that actually adhere to the actual play that's on the field, they wouldn't have a league that is so geared. They wouldn't have a league that's so out of whack. If they wanted to change it, Bo, they would. They don't. This is a league that is headline driven anyway. So yeah, these type of things happen even in the playoffs where they never should ever happen. Like that to me, that's why this whole thing feels diminished. Like it's the NFC Championship, Bo, and you'd think I would be happy because the Seahawks are 60 minutes away from going to back-to-back Super Bowls, and yet it feels to me that the NFL should be ashamed of what has happened.
Well, okay, a couple things. The Lions in that wild card game didn't score a single point in the second half. That's why they lost that game.
Right. Just
Dallas forgot to play defense and had a key turnover in the fourth quarter. That's why Dallas lost that game. Now that being said, it was probably. I've looked at the play against Detroit. I don't know how many times, and every time I look at it, I see something different. I mean, that's a call. That's a rule. Face guarding is not illegal.
It's not illegal, but I also see. I think it's what his name is. What Hitchens?
Yeah,
Hitchens. I also see every single replay I see Hitchens' hand on the shoulder of Pettigrew. I think it's Pettigrew, right?
Yeah,
and that's the whole thing. I mean, you have to understand. Hold on. You have to understand, and I've read this rule time and time again. I've even asked players over the last 2 weeks, NFL players, about this rule, and they basically said, listen, you are limited. If you are playing the player and you decide to face guard, that's fine because it's legal, but you literally cannot put a hand in any manner on the receiver.
Now,
and there is clear as day, there is a hand on the right shoulder of Pettigrew right there.
Yeah.
Even though it looks like he's falling away from the ball, you literally cannot put your hand in any manner on the receiver.
I understand that.
There is a reason why that flag flew.
I understand that, but there's a couple things here. Did that contact happen after the ball hit Hitchens? That's one thing I looked at. But you also have to notice there was a face mask on the receiver on Hitchens. What should have been ruled there was offsetting penalties. Got hands in the face by the wide receiver,
and
you replay third and one.
Yeah.
That's the way it should have been ruled. And if we could actually review these plays
and also that's the whole thing.
If we'd actually review these,
and
then that's probably what would have happened.
And I would really love the NFL if they said, "Listen, you still have two challenges per game, but those challenges you can review anything."
Yeah,
anything.
Now, in terms of the Dez.
I go, listen, when it comes
to when we actually look at the play, let me finish. When you look at the play, fast motion, slow motion, it looks like a catch. Now, the rule states he has to maintain control of the football all the way to the ground.
From start to finish, right?
So,
and
technically speaking, yes. Okay?
Not a
catch. But that is also a rule.
Now
would it happen to Calvin Johnson was when they should have changed that rule.
Now here's
and they
here's,
definitely should change it now because that's a stupid rule.
Here's what I'm saying, and from basically before he actually started the football move, and the football move is when he was falling backwards and he had his arm. You could see clear possession of the ball. He had control of the ball as he's reaching for the goal line, just like he always does. Right.
Right.
Now, when he first initially made the catch until when he's starting to come down, when he's starting to pull the ball down, you see him bobbling the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that's where there's no possession. But yet, who gives a shit, right? Who really – excuse me. And excuse me. Who really gives a damn about whether or not he had possession from where he initially made the catch? Because here's the thing. If you have possession while you make that football move, you have possession of the ball.
Yeah, and you're supposed to make a football move that classifies possession, right?
Do you remember those old NFL blooper films where you always see the quarterback hitting, dumping off in the flats to running backs, and you always see them, you see the ball tipping off the fingers of the running back as he's bobbling in the air, but ultimately he catches the ball, and then he turns up fields and runs? Well, that's the exact same thing. Of course, he didn't have initial control of the ball, but he had control when it mattered the most as he's making a football move upfield. Dez Bryant had the control of the ball as he made a football move upfield. So it doesn't matter whether or not he had possession. He didn't have possession for 0.3 of a second. He had possession when it mattered the most is when he made that football play. To me, it was a catch by definition of the fact that if he didn't have possession – as he was making that football play, then then whatever. I mean, that's it's an incomplete pass. I think what's kind of funny about this is I just find it very disconcerting that the NFL condones this type of behavior.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Especially in the – if this was – again, I always get back to this. If this was in the regular season, Bo, I don't think either of us would have cared.
No.
Right? Because you still have 8 more games to get to the playoffs. And if you fail to make the playoffs, well, then you still had 8 more games.
Right.
Right? But this is either win or go home. And you cannot have referees deciding the outcomes of these type of things. If this didn't happen in Detroit, and if that – let's just say the call doesn't stand – and the pass was complete, there you would probably lead to the conclusion that Detroit would have went down and at least kicked a field goal.
Right.
You know what I mean? It would have kicked the field goal, and then at that point, it's a 2-possession game for the Cowboys, not a 1-possession game, and so they still have to come back down the field again to at least take the lead or tie, and maybe Detroit wins that ball game.
Maybe. Maybe they score in the second half too. That's the thing, and that's why I don't blame. I don't blame officials for wins and losses.
Yeah, see, that's the whole thing. But I do to an extent because I do believe in momentum. And as a former athlete, I understand all about momentum.
Oh, sure.
And so, and these type of things are soul crushing. Now, to me, if I was the head coach of Detroit in that situation, Bo, I would have went for it on 4th-and-1 because there's only one way you can get over that type of momentum swing is shove it down their throat and get a first down.
Yeah.
I would never punted it, but whatever, I digress. So anyway, getting back to the topic at hand, man, I wanted to talk a little bit about this because I don't know how you feel, man, but this is exactly why that my interest in the NFL has diminished so much because it has basically became a parody of what it once was.
Well,
Bo, it feels like the WWE.
Well, I'll tell you this. You know, I think that part of it, Steve, it's not necessarily that the quality of the officials has gone down. I think it's that there's so many rules now that they have to use. There's a rule against everything. That's why you see so many flags.
I think when the NFL decided to sell its soul for money and really change the rules to gear it towards an offensive game, that's when the rules started to either increase or change.
Yeah.
Now you have so many offensive rules, so many ticky-tack rules to protect the offensive side of the ball that we have these type of things now. And as we've seen, we've seen, especially with the Dez Bryant, that it holds accountability. If we're going to make this an offensive game, then we have to have accountability for offensive stars. But then again, you would think something like that would kind of go against the grain. But it's kind of funny because I want to talk about these AFC Championship games. I want to talk about the AFC Championship and the NFC Championship, Bo. But I had to touch on this because to me, the NFL is a complete shell of itself. Like it's not NBA bad. Like the NBA to me is something completely different. It will never recover. I think the NBA is in a much different situation, a much dire situation, but the NFL is slowly kind of getting to that point where I look at it almost like, you know, almost kind of like a laughingstock, though.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, there's not a ref that's been indicted for colluding with the mob to throw games. I'm not saying that. Like, it's not Tim Donaghy bad. But this is pretty bad. Like when you're having these type of things, like this is why the NBA is the way it is, because when the NBA, especially back in the early 2000s, when you just kind of had a feeling that the NBA needed big market teams to showcase in the finals, and so you had like teams like Sacramento getting screwed, teams like Portland getting screwed because they understood what that would mean for ratings in the finals. So you needed the Lakers there to draw. And so, yeah, maybe you would have your refs in a pivotal game completely just demolish a team like that. Like, I don't want to sit here and say that the NFL is at that level, but it makes you think. It makes you think because you know the NFL is all about ratings. You know the NFL is all about ratings, and you know that a Dallas-Green Bay game is a lot favorable for ratings than a Detroit-Seattle game or a Detroit-Green Bay game. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying.
I don't think there's a conspiracy. I think the NFL would like to see those games, but they're not going to orchestrate it on the field.
But what's funny about this is, like, I'll give you a good example. Major League Baseball is great, and I was talking with Jason Churchill about this list last Saturday. The thing I love about Major League Baseball now is they embrace every market. Like, that's kind of fun. What's funny about this is San Francisco, even though they've won three titles in the last 5 years, never would you – I don't consider San Francisco a big market team. Like, there's really only, like, both New York teams, both Chicago teams. The Dallas-Fort Worth area is a pretty big market television-wise. L.A., obviously. But really, for the most part, San Francisco was always a – the Giants were always a franchise that were – they hadn't won a World Series since they even moved to San Francisco. They won three of the last five. That's great. Kansas City hasn't even been to the playoffs since the last time they won a World Series. And Major League Baseball embraced these two markets. Embraced them and loved the fact that, you know, a market like Kansas City can bask in the glow of their biggest stage, which is the World Series. And it was a phenomenal World Series. Phenomenal World Series.
It was.
And yet what's kind of funny is the NFL revolts against teams like Seattle or Tampa Bay that's hosted up Super Bowls because they want New England. They want the Boston market. They want the Jets and the Giants to be there. Like, their ideal Super Bowl is Patriots-Jets. Well, Patriots-Giants. You know what I mean? It's a team, it's a league that wants Dallas. It's a team that wants to get back into L.A. so bad, so bad. You know what I mean? Like, it is. What's kind of funny is that's why Major League Baseball to me is a breath of fresh air, because they embrace the small market teams. They embrace every single team. And yet, you know, we see things like this. Like, we don't see even borderline calls in Major League Baseball's playoffs. You know, it's just something that just doesn't happen. It's something that doesn't happen, and yet continuously now for two straight weeks. What's to say something like this couldn't happen in the NFC Championship? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
And I think that's also one of the biggest problems, too, is fans going into a big game, you just know that the officials are supposed to be the one group of people that you never notice.
You know, can you understand?
And you just know you're going to have a game dominated by this call and this ticky-tack and that ticky-tack and this maybe a literal interpretation of the rules, but let your eyes tell you, he made that catch. You know, I mean, that's what you're expecting now when you watch an NFL game. And that's not the way it should be. Yeah, you know, you watch a baseball game, and unless there's a bad strike zone, an inconsistent strike zone, there's a bad call at first base, you don't even see the umpires. You know,
right.
You don't notice
right.
their presence. You don't notice the presence of NBA or hockey officials because they let them play the game.
Right.
And the NFL, it seems like, it's almost like Monica Geller from Friends where, you know, rules make the game fun. No, they don't.
Wow. I love it. Great, great Monica Geller drop right there. That was a reference that I had, nobody could see that one coming, Bo. By the way, kudos to you. That's a good drop. All right, so here's what we're going to do.
You get my point, though.
I get your point. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the national championship. Okay, so Cardale Jones, three straight wins, three very big wins. Wisconsin, Alabama, now Oregon. Very good stuff. We'll get into it next. You're listening to the Steve Silver Show, Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, it's DT with Vern Wow. You'll be saying wow every time you use this auto insurance. It's like a Seahawk, it's like a towel, it's like an insurance plan. A regular insurance plan won't work with blemishes on your record. Vern Wow works. For the car, the RV, the Sasquatch.
Hey, what's up, bro?
Serving the Northwest for 25 years, not Germany. Why insure Germans? Police officers, they use it to wipe off donut crumbs. Here's your driving record. Let's add speeding tickets, reckless driving, and DUIs. Not only is the damage on top, there's your driving record. What a mess. We're going to do this in real time. Look at this. Put Vern Wow to work for you. Vern Wow already soaks up 50% of your insurance problems right there. Does this look like your driving record, camera guy? The other 50% gets you right back on the road. No other insurance company is going to do that. It acts like a protection. And look at this, virtually a clean driving record. Vern Wow, you'll be saying wow every time.
I can't live without it. I just love it.
Oh, my God, I don't even have to take the bus anymore.
Vern Wow saved my marriage.
All I can say is, Vern
Wow.
You're going to be spending hundreds of dollars on insurance anyways. You're throwing your money away. But if you log on to vernfunk.com in the next 30 minutes, because we can't do this all day.
Find out how to get a free T-shirt with every SR22 purchase. Here's how to order.
Vern Funk is an auto insurance agency in the Northwest, serving Everett, Eastside, Seattle, Tacoma, the Coop, and Port.
We're here asking people from all over what they think of Lipton green tea. Let's hear what people from Texas have to say.
Mm-mm.
How about China?
Mmm.
Germany?
Mmm.
How about people from the North Pole?
Mmm.
Or Mars? It, what about mimes? Oh, right. People with their jaws wired shut?
Oh.
Yeah, a barbershop quartet.
Mmm.
Oh, you guys are great. How about race car drivers?
Mmm.
Yeah, what about you, high school glee club, here on a field trip? Well, that settles it. It sounds like everyone loves the taste of Lipton green tea. With its protective antioxidants from real tea, it's not just good for you, it's mmm to you. Lipton tea can do that.
Welcome back to the program. Steve Silver along with Bo Reed and Hall
of Oates back. They're back.
They are back.
They had like a 2-month vacation from the show.
I can listen to Hall of Oates.
I'm right there with you.
I love that. By the way, I love that synthetic little keyboard. Dee doo dee doo. Yeah, you know, you gotta love it, man. You gotta love that '80s pop, that serious pop. It's not that little poppy Tiffany Debbie Gibson pop, but it's like cutting edge hardcore pop. It's like towing the line.
You know, either that or the saxophone. That was big in the '80s.
That was kind of big. Anyway, welcome back to the program. 714-816-4704 is the phone number. You can hit us up on Twitter at InsiderSteve, at LTR Reed. Bo, the national championship game went down. I think, to me, this was probably one of the better national championship games that we've seen in the last, 15 years. We've seen some pretty decent ones, but for the most part, this was, I think this playoff went the way that I think everybody thought it was going to go. You had four teams that get in. This national championship, to me, it's funny because coming into it, Bo, I had picked Oregon, but it was with absolutely zero confidence. To me, picking against Urban Meyer in these type of situations is right. Pretty much like picking against Tom Brady. And sure enough, you know, a team that was led by a third string quarterback, Cardale Jones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I give credit to Marcus Mariota for keeping the Ducks in for as long as they did, but ultimately you just knew that Ohio State was going to figure this thing out, pull it out when they needed to pull it out, and sure enough, they are the national champions. Bo, I tip your hands to Urban Meyer. I mean, I think he's only one of three college coaches to win a national championship at two different schools,
yep.
And he did it. And I think this was the most impressive effort is the fact that he did it with a third string quarterback. I guess the question I have for you today is, was this really all about Ohio State, or was this about the fact that Oregon was missing seven really key components off of offense, and really Marcus Mariota didn't have necessarily the weapons that he was accustomed to? Because maybe you would think that if he had if full strength, maybe this might be a little bit – this we would probably be talking about Oregon as the national champions, not the Ohio State Buckeyes.
Well, I think that the game would have certainly been closer if they weren't missing so many players on offense. But I tell you what, Ohio State played a flawless football game.
Yeah, they did.
Flawless.
Yeah,
flawless, perfect football game, which we said last week they had to do to beat Oregon. I think that the score would have been closer, but Ohio State, the way they played, probably still pulls that out, even if Oregon's at full strength. Ohio State played that good of a football game.
One of the things that surprised me was the fact that Ohio State's defense was not even concerned at all about the speed of Oregon's offense. I think that was the one thing that I wouldn't say surprised me, because I've seen Ohio State pretty much from the second half of the year, so I understood exactly what areas they were going to be able to succeed. But they really kept Marcus Mariota in the pocket.
I think for me, that was the biggest troubling thing about it was Marcus Mariota couldn't do the things that Marcus Mariota successful, which is use that sleight of hand to get out of the pocket and use his athleticism, whether it's throwing on the run or even tucking it and then running it. He was unable to really get a rhythm in that sense. Now, granted, he did on the first drive of the game, and after Oregon scored and it was 7-0, people were like, well, okay, there you go. But for the most part, that was it. And Ohio State literally kept him in the pocket, and that was it.
Yeah.
That was it for Mark.
That was it. And look, when you're limited on your options as a quarterback, no matter how good you are, and I think he's got one heck of an NFL career ahead of him. I'm sure we'll talk about that later.
But
you know, at the same time, you take away that many weapons, you are going to handicap a quarterback no matter how good they are.
Right.
They're going to be handicapped. But I think if we talk too much about Oregon missing players and not playing with a full
you're taking away a lot of Ohio State. And what's kind of funny is Oregon's defense all year has been good, but they have not been great. But Ezekiel Jones in that game, the running back for Ohio State, Ezekiel Smith had a phenomenal game running the football. And Cardell Jones, say what you will about Cardell Jones, I mean, this is a kid, third-string quarterback, beat Wisconsin. Didn't just beat Wisconsin, beat down Wisconsin, in the Big Ten championship game. Then beats Alabama in the Sugar Bowl, and then beats Oregon in the national championship game. Three of the biggest games that most quarterbacks don't have the lower intestinal fortitude to handle.
Yeah,
this kid, a third stringer no less, beats all three, including showing the athleticism. That's the thing I like about Cardell Jones is the dude is built like a linebacker. The dude's a tank, has a zip for an arm, and he goes out there, Bo, and literally just plays the game without an ounce of fear. Now, I guess the question I have for you is that inexperience, or is that just is that the type of optimism that you want to see out of a third stringer?
Well, you know, I think honestly, you know, you look at his quotes over the course of the last few days. I mean, everyone was talking about how your draft stock is never going to be higher. You're going to be a first round pick.
I think that's all bogus. I think that's all bogus, by the way.
I think it's bogus. But look at what he said. He said the time has to be right.
Right.
You know, he says he wants to – it means nothing to him without an education. He's not – I think what stuck out to me is when he actually admitted, I'm not ready for the NFL. I wish Johnny Manziel had admitted that. I wish some of these other college quarterbacks would admit the fact that they're not ready for the NFL yet and stay in school.
Well, that's what Mariota said a year ago. I mean, Mariota could have been number one in the draft board last year and said, I'm just not ready. Well, what's kind of funny about this with Cardell Jones is – he better go back to school. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, he better. And I would think that in the scope of everything, the fact that number one, and by the way, this was just reported two hours ago ESPN. Cardell Jones has said. He has said that he is going to come back, and he said he basically says, okay, here's his quote. I don't know why you guys made such a big deal. Like I said, it was very simple for me. Basically exactly what you said. It was an issue of him not being ready. And when you look at this and when you look at what's going on at Ohio State, that number one, Braxton Miller is going to transfer. I think at this point in time, when you have guys like JT Barrett and Cardell Jones, I think at this point you probably think that Braxton Miller is going to go to a place where he can enhance his draft stock, and maybe LSU has been thrown out there for a minute. So he's already. I think Braxton Miller's already graduated, so he can transfer without losing that year of eligibility.
LSU would be good.
He can transfer anywhere, and I fully expect that to happen. But Cardell Jones, to me, when you look at his three-game body of work, I would probably think that Urban Meyer is going to be in a situation where he's going to verbally explain it to Cardell Jones that he's going to have to earn it. But I think secretly, he's going to go into that camp as being the number one. It's going to be his job to lose.
Right.
You know, like, I have a feeling that he's going to roll with Cardale Jones over a guy like JT Barrett, who actually was playing pretty well. But I think when you have this kind of resume where your first game is the Big Ten Championship and you obliterate Wisconsin, your
yep.
second game of your career is against Alabama and you beat Nick Saban, and
yep.
then your third game of your career is the National Championship where you beat the Heisman Trophy winner.
Yeah.
I would think going into – if I was a head coach and you have Ezekiel Smith coming back, the running back, who's a redshirt sophomore – and you have, I think it's something crazy, 10 of your 11 defensive starters are coming back, and I think it's like 9 of your starting 11 on offense are coming back. Like, you have a very good situation there in Columbus where you can possibly see this as being, you could not just win this year, but also like next year as well too. And if you do that and you go back to school, as he is, and you win another national championship and you do it again, or
yeah.
let's even say that you just get into the playoff and you get to the national championship game and you have a very good Sugar Bowl or Orange Bowl, whatever the case may be. Now all of a sudden you're going from this year being right now like a third or fourth pick, or maybe even being high as a second pick. Now you're going to being a guaranteed top five pick.
Yeah. No, yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think just back to my point, you know, he asked me if this was essentially just overconfidence. No.
No.
No, I just think that he understands the situation he's in. He has great players around him, great running game, great defense, all the intangibles were there for Ohio State. All he had to do was not mess up, and he didn't, over 3 games. Now, does he have a lot he needs to improve on? Of course he does. He's only started 3 games at the college level, which is why I found the whole why doesn't he go pro argument ridiculous.
Absolutely.
Okay? This is a kid that clearly gets it. Just like Mariota in Oregon gets it. And those are the kind of quarterbacks that actually go on and have successful NFL careers. It's not the Johnny Manziels of the world that think that the NFL is going to be just like college, he can do what he wants. It's kids like this. Kids that understand that the leap from college to the NFL, especially at the quarterback position, is a huge leap. It's bigger than from AAA to the majors in baseball and hockey. It's bigger than college or even high school to the NBA. It's a big leap, and the kids that get it and understand that are going to be the ones that actually work to improve, work on their game. They work on it when they get there. They don't go out and have parties midweek going into a game they have to start. That's the kind of kid that gets it. That's the kind of kid that's going to actually have a successful NFL career.
This just coming in over the wire. Can Braxton Miller transfer to WSU? Yes, he can.
Yes, he can.
Yes, he can.
He can go wherever he wants.
Can Braxton Miller go to Texas? Yes, he can.
I'm all about that. That's
yeah,
awesome.
I know you're all about that, but yes, I would love to see Braxton Miller in Crimson and Gray. Yes, I would. No, you're absolutely right. And what's interesting about this is, you know, and getting into a little bit about, you know, these quarterbacks that are, you know, especially this upcoming year, you know, the difference between Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota, Bo. I'm not a big fan of Jameis Winston when it comes to his pro stock. I just don't think the guy is mentally ready to handle the rigors. I'm not saying that the guy can't play. I think he can play. I just don't think he's mentally mature enough to handle what's set in front of him. What I will say, though, is what I will say about Marcus Mariota, if you're to all the teams out there that are thinking about drafting Marcus Mariota, whether it's Tennessee or whether it's Tampa Bay or whoever it may be, you have to be able, Bo, you have to be able to play to the style of his game. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by this is we've seen this now with Colin Kaepernick, and we've seen this now with RG3. It's different with Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson is just a different cat who understands how to play football. He was mentally
right.
ready, and he was readily mentally ready to do whatever it took to be great. That was
yep.
different. Push that aside, okay? Guys like RG3 and guys like Colin Kaepernick have to run a specific system because it accentuates their strengths, okay? These guys
yeah.
are athletic people. Athletic guys that has to run an offense that's conducive to their strengths, because when you allow these guys to use their athletic ability, everything else makes their arms better. Okay, so like I'll give you a good example. Like when RG3 and when Colin Kaepernick are able to run this read option, and they're able to get outside the pocket and use and basically stretch the field with their athleticism, they allow them it makes their arms a little bit better. They're not inside the pocket passers. They're outside the pocket passers. And that is Marcus Mariota. Marcus Mariota has all the throws down. Like, he can make every throw.
Yep.
From watching this dude over the last 3 years, I can tell you definitively he can make the throws. What he can't do is sit in the pocket and make those throws. He has to be able to get outside the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
But once he does, he can make those throws. A team has to commit to the player and understand that his strengths are going to be conducive. And I understand that. I get it, man. NFL defenses are going to game plan for that, but whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. I don't want to hear anything other than, okay, fine. If that's the case, then you add different wrinkles into the read option. So you bring more athleticism to the table outside of just your quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You bring in an athletic running back. You do some other things that will counter what Mariota can bring to the table. But the thing, you can't ask him to do something that he is not capable of doing. And if you want to, then you know what? You sit him for a year.
Mm-hmm.
You redshirt him for a year at the pro level and let the Zach Mettenberger be your starting quarterback. For good or bad, let him be your starting quarterback and teach this kid how to play the NFL game. If you're not going to do that and you're going to start him right away, which I fully understand, then you have to play the game that's suitable for him, Bo. And you have to do it for more than just one season.
Absolutely. I'm with you. I mean, RG3 had a great rookie year.
The Redskins demolished RG3.
Yeah.
they're the ones that led to it.
Absolutely.
Anyways, yeah.
No, I'm with you, man. I mean, yeah, RG3 had a great rookie year because they did accentuate his talent, and then they stopped. And they haven't picked it up since. And guess what? He struggles.
Hmm.
That's why when you look at these quarterbacks, you have to look at the guy that can make every throw on the field. Not just a guy that can run and throw. A guy that can sit in the pocket and make every throw on the field. Roll out, make a throw downfield, hit his tight end 10, 12 yards for a first down. They've got to be able to do everything. If you want them to be the star quarterback, and we talked about this a little last week, you know, there's only a handful of star quarterbacks in football because the college quarterback pool has become so diluted by college schemes and college systems.
Yes.
That you've got to really find that diamond in the rough to get a Tom Brady, to get a Peyton Manning.
Right.
You've got to find...
The way that I look at this, Bo, is, you know, Jameis Winston has a body like Cam Newton where it's like you're not really worried about the durability. And so maybe he can sit in the pocket and he can. The thing I don't like about Jameis Winston is the fact that I don't think he's got all the throws down. I don't think he's going to be a guy that's going to be conducive to the NFL. You know, I mean, yeah, he played a good Rose Bowl, but in the NFL game, he did. He played a pretty decent Rose Bowl game, but he didn't have the game. He didn't have the game. You know what I mean? I don't know, man. I look at this as just saying that if it were me, I'm taking Marcus Mariota. If I have the number one pick, I'm taking Marcus Mariota just because of the athletic ability. The thing that I don't like about Jameis Winston is the fact that I just don't know what I'm getting. It's what I don't know that's going to scare me off.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. You know, honestly, the first time I've said this, in years? But I think in Mariota, you've got a guy that could step in week one and actually be a good quarterback. Would he benefit by?
Let me ask you a question.
For a year, yeah, but there's finally a quarterback that can maybe do what Russell Wilson did, but you can actually predict it this time.
Can let me ask you a question? If you were a GM and you had the number one pick, would you draft him, Mariota, with the eye of starting week one?
I think it depends on the situation.
Right.
If
you're going to a bad team, regardless.
You're going to a bad team, so I think it depends on the quarterback situation.
In Tampa Bay specifically, you do have McCown.
Right.
You do have McCown where if you want to play him for, like, it was the Blake Bortles situation in Jacksonville where you get Bortles, but, you know, you have Henny and you're going to start him for a couple, you know, you're going to start him for a couple games and see what you got with Henny, and if he wets the bed, then you can go to Bortles, which they did ultimately. I think I would favor that type of situation. But then again, I mean, I a part of me thinks that none of these quarterbacks are ready to start week one. You know what I mean? Like I would think that if it were me, we're not going to be good anyway. Even with them on the field, we're not going to be good. So we might as well be bad with McCown and just go and it's fine, because by week 8, week 9, week 10, when you know that you're out of it, you can go to your rookie. You can go to that well, get maybe even week 12 and give him the last quarter of the season, get his feet. Like I hate to say this, because I know that you don't like to hear this name at all. I know you don't like to hear the name Tim Tebow. but you have to give Denver credit here, though, because when Tebow was drafted, like, he was not even an option until the last, like, 2 weeks of the season.
Right.
They were out of it, and they still didn't want to go to it, and then they did for the last couple weeks of the season, and he got a nice little got a nice little cup of coffee, and then the next year, that was springboarded him into that next year. It almost seems like this would be the ideal situation where if we're going to be bad with this guy. And then when the time is right to get some seasoning, when he's had enough practice reps, then we'll give him some reps with the first team. We'll get him out there in some game situations. We'll get him acquiesce to the speed of the NFL game, and then we'll just let him loose.
Should we start? I think this is a valid question to ask right now. I'm going to ask you this now. Which team makes the Winston mistake? Because there's always that one quarterback that you just know is a mistake. Manziel was it last year.
I will tell you.
Who's going to make the Winston mistake?
The New York Jets. He sounds like a New York Jet. Actually, you know what would be funny is if the Buffalo.
Even with Geno Smith?
No, it would be funny if the Buffalo Bills drafted him, because, you know, the whole Rex Ryan is a complete, you know, the whole. Yeah, he just erodes just bad offense, so that would be just that would be great.
Well, I don't think he's going to slip that far down. I think that the one team that I'm watching that actually could make this mistake is the Washington Redskins at 5.
Yeah, I don't see that happening. I actually don't think that. I don't think Winston's going to be off the board. Is going to be on the board past the first two picks. Both of those teams, both Tampa Bay and both Tennessee, need a quarterback, and I would probably think that these two guys are going to go 1-2.
Yeah, and I think they're going in that order. I just think Tampa Bay, you know, you got a guy in Mariota that, you know, it's going to be rough sledding while you build a team around him, but you got a guy that projects out to be that franchise-level type quarterback.
All right, Bo, it's that point in the time where we were going to do our Whopper freakouts, but I flipped the switch on you. Yeah, of course I did. It is random questions. Random questions by Steve.
Because I did so well on those last week.
That's right. Question number one. The Detroit Tigers are what right now?
They're a contender. Mainly because the Central, it's not like the American League West, where you've got to be very good to win that division. You can win it being just a contender. But they're also, the Indians are in the mix. The Royals should be in the mix. It's hard to really put a thumb on what they are. I mean, I know they're a contender, but how serious of a contender are they? I mean, are they just a divisional contender, or can they actually make some noise in the playoffs? And I think a lot of that depends on, do they bring Scherzer back? Do they deal David Price?
There's no way they're going to deal David Price. I will say this. Right now, the Detroit Tigers are the second best team in this division behind the Cleveland Indians, and I said it last week on record, on point, on the Hot Stove Report, because we talked about this last week, and I will say this right now, balance-wise, again, if you ask me the best team with the best balance in the Central, it is the Cleveland Indians. I love that rotation. Now, again, when you look at the Detroit Tigers and you see Justin Verlander and you see David Price, it's kind of hard to argue against that. And they get Anibal Sanchez back, who will be healthy. So you look at those top three and you're like, okay, well, that's cool. But this is also a team that, again, has ignored their bullpen and are looking for bounce back years. And so when you fail to address the depth, you trade starting pitching depth, which you couldn't, and you double down on offense. Bo, I'm sorry, you can have all the offense you want, but I am taking the team with the balance. Right now, the Detroit Tigers, to me, are the second-best team in the Central right now.
I'll agree with that.
The Toronto Blue Jays are what?
Oh, gosh. The Blue Jays.
Yep.
Interesting. Winner. East, the Orioles. Down a
good winners. They had a good winner.
Red Sox, they had a good, that's why I'm trying to look through the American League East right now. The Red Sox are probably going to tread water, maybe get a little better because they do have a good lineup. The Yankees are taking a step back.
I think the Red Sox are probably going to win this division, but
I think right now it's 1A and 1B between the Red Sox and Blue Jays.
I will say this. The Blue Jays are frauds. Frauds. F-R-A-U-D-S, because you know what? I don't care what they do. This is a team that still, again, has refused to address the areas of need, which are pitching. Pitching, pitching, pitching. This is a team that could have, should be on the open market for James Shields. They should have at least, at this point, brought at least four starters to at least add some depth to the back end of it. I'm not sold on this bullpen. This is a bullpen that I've never really liked. And it's a rotation.
Like the Blue Jays.
No, seriously, I like the Blue Jays lineup. I've always liked their lineup. Their lineup is not what drives me crazy. It's the fact that every single year they still do not. What have we said? By the way, what have we said about the Blue Jays for the last three seasons combined? If they just got enough pitching to at least augment their offense, this team would run away with this division every single year. And every single year they fail to address it. I'm looking at this projected starting rotation, and I see to myself, cool, R.A. Dickey, he's not an ace really anymore. He had one good season in New York, got the money, goes to Toronto. He's okay. I'm not saying that he's bad. He's okay. You have Mark Burley, who, by the way, probably has not been as good as he was since he was in Chicago. Drew Hutchinson, Marcus Stroman, Daniel Norris. What I'm saying is...
How old is Burley now? Like 80?
No, he's like 30. He's almost 36. R.A. Dickey's 40. And then they got three pitchers that are under the age of 25, and Hutchinson, Stroman, and Norris. But let me be clear. This was a team that needed to go out and spend on pitching. As a matter of fact, we heard this from Chris Mitchell, our good friend, who said, you know what, they should have been in the Andrew Miller sweepstakes. They should have been in the David Robertson sweepstakes, because here's the thing. If you're not going to go out and spend on money on free agents starting pitching, do exactly what the Royals did last year. They doubled down on their bullpen. If you have a shut down, lights-out bullpen, you can withstand the back third of your rotation, and you can shorten the game to the sixth inning, and all you ask for some of these young guys is just not to be god-awful for 5 1/3 innings. Hold opposition to at least four runs. Our offense can score eight. We can give it to our bullpen and we can be fine. They didn't do that. They did not even come close to doing that. And you know what? This is going to be a team that, by the way, Jose Reyes is probably going to go down with an injury. Russell Martin's probably going to go down with an injury. You're going to have about four different injuries, and this team is going to finish either last or it's going to finish second to last.
Because not about last.
This team did not do what it needed to do.
Let me ask this.
Frauds.
Real quick question for you, because we are on the AL East.
Yeah.
Do you think that Joe Maddon going to the Cubs is going to spark perhaps a new stat, Mr. Statman? Maybe we add a war to the managers?
By the way, that was the best offseason move.
It was.
Was Joe Maddon the manager going to the Cubs?
I think we're about to find out what Joe Madden's wins above replacement would be.
Right, yeah, it's MWAR.
There you go.
Yeah, right. So what does Lloyd McClendon mean to the Mariners as far as
MR?
Again, man, they're frauds. Here's the question, giving Jason Garrett a 5-year extension after one playoff victory was what?
Genius.
What?
It was genius. Now, you have to look at more than just this year. You have to look at the improvements he's made year after year as head coach of the Dallas Cowboys. And I think you saw this year everything come together for Garrett. He finally had an offensive line so he could run the football. He could take a little of the pressure off of Tony Romo. Now, if they go into the draft, go into free agency, which I've heard, and I'm not saying this is a valid verified rumor, but I've heard Dallas is going to go all in on DeMarco Sue. if they now address that defense and at least make that defense a top 10 defense with the offense they have, you're talking about the Cowboys being a Super Bowl contender next year. It's a young team, and it's molded in Jason Garrett's philosophy, and you finally saw that come together this year. I see what you're saying. It was one good year. I get that. But you look at the total body of work for Jason Garrett, and you see everything you need to see for the head coach of the Dallas Cowboys. And it's also, let's also not forget, he's a guy that can tell Jerry Jones not to draft a guy like Johnny Manziel, and Jerry Jones will listen. He's not a yes man, like all these other coaches that Jerry Jones has had since Jimmy Johnson, but he doesn't have the ego and the emotions that Jimmy Johnson had. This is a relationship between two, you know, owner and head coach that could go on for quite some time and win multiple Super Bowls. I think it was genius.
This was a joke, in my opinion, because, you know, here's the thing. This was Jerry Jones' bravado written all over this, because, you know what, you look at this type of year and you try to blow this thing up into the biggest thing that you can possibly do, because, you know what, let's keep this real, okay? As far as I'm concerned, the Dallas Cowboys overachieved in a division that was decimated by injuries and inconsistency. When you look at the Philadelphia Eagles, that team was obliterated by injuries at the most key position. And also, they also had a few defensive injuries that also cost them as well, too. I'm not taking anything away from what Dallas did, because they clearly took advantage of what I consider was the weakest schedule in the NFL. They took advantage exactly of what they were supposed to do. When you have that type of cupcake schedule, that's exactly what you were supposed to do. Now, what I will say is, you know what, big-time performances by Dez Bryant, big-time performances by DeMarco Murray all season long. But here's the thing. You cannot justify a five-year contract extension for a coach that really has done absolutely nothing. Has done nothing in his tenure as a Dallas coach to reward that. And, by the way, that's nice. You had a playoff victory, which is good because, well, quite frankly, in the history of Tony Romo, he's only had two, so it's not really that big of a scope. And in the context of this season, that's cool. But here's what I'm saying. Usually 5-year contract extensions are rewarded to coaches that actually did something, you know, that actually had a track record leading up to this type of year, which facilitated the need to extend him, because you would probably feel like there's nothing better out there on the open market. But what I will say is there's something clearly better on the open market, but this is just Jerry Jones being exactly what he is and saying, "See, I told you, this dude has the goods." And, by the way, is tied to a quarterback. I'm going to be honest with you, man. And you know how I feel about Tony Romo. Mm-hmm. Okay? The greatest thing that they did was take the ball out of Tony Romo's hands. But you know what? It's Tony Romo. Okay? It's Tony freaking Romo, who's probably not going to win a thing in Dallas. What I will say is to this. I would have done this after next year. I would have extended him for 1 year and go into the 16th season. And it said, okay, listen, here's the deal. You do it again. Let's just say that the Cowboys did it again next year. Had a 12-4, won the East, goes into the playoffs, and then this time, you know, gets to the championship or something like that. You know what I mean? At least do it again. Put together a couple of decent seasons back-to-back, a couple of division-winning seasons back-to-back where you actually can facilitate the need. To me, we were talking a little bit about Evan Gattis, where you think it was 1 year or 2 years too early. Well, this seems to me like a year too early for Jason Garrett, considering that really, for the most part, it's been mediocre at best up to this point, and then you have this one isolated year where really it really was not his game planning that led to it. It was basically, okay, fine, here's what we're going to do. And it proved to be okay. That's good, but it's still, when it counted the most, it still didn't really amount. It still really didn't amount to anything. It still didn't bear fruit. This whole thing was Jerry Jones just doing what Jerry Jones does best, which is saying, "See, I told you he wasn't who we all thought he was." Even though everybody knows who he is, what he thought he was. I got to be honest with you, man. Fine, if you want to keep him around for at least 3 years because of consistency and continuity, fine, I understand that. Just say that. Okay, that's fine. So everybody's familiar with what Jason Garrett is going to do. Everybody likes Jason Garrett. Well, just say that. Don't bring the fluff out. Just say it. It's for a continuity standpoint. And if you keep a guy around there long enough and we keep adding to it, you know, who's to say that we can't get to the Super Bowl? That's understandable. That's understandable. But don't come at me with fluff. You know, don't come at me with headlines and don't come at me with fluff. Because up to this point, Jason Garrett has basically wet the bed, and he's his boy. Jason Garrett is Jerry Jones's boy. Okay.
Okay.
Just say it, man.
I'm going to draw some stats on you.
Go ahead. By the way, for everybody that's tuning in, mind you, Bo is a Dallas Cowboys fan. So these stats just might be biased towards one end. I'm just saying. Go ahead.
Okay. You want to talk head coaches? Head coaches, Cowboys history. Head coaches. Mr. Jimmy Johnson, outside of Tom Landry, probably the most recognizable coach of the Dallas Cowboys in our history.
Go ahead.
Jimmy Johnson, 80 games coached, 44 wins. Jason Garrett, 72 games coached, 41 wins. He is 3 wins away from tying, 4 from passing Jimmy Johnson in wins.
Okay.
And he's doing it in less time.
All I know is 3 straight 8-8 seasons without the playoffs.
3 straight 8-8 seasons with a bad football team that's finally being rebuilt the right
way. Some of those football teams were pretty good and they were decimated by injuries. What I will say is this, when it's mattered the most, you can give me the division title, cool, whatever, man. But when it comes down to it the most, and you just said this earlier in the show, that it wasn't a call that lost the Dallas Cowboys game. It was a turnover by Tony Romo early in the fourth quarter.
Oh, that was DeMarco Murray.
Okay, excuse me. It was a turnover by DeMarco Murray, and it was the fact that really, for the most part, they allowed Aaron Rodgers to systematically tear him apart.
Yeah.
So that's the whole thing, was when it came down to crunch time, the Dallas Cowboys did exactly what they do, and that's...
Whoa, I don't think that's fair. No, I don't think that's fair at all. You're talking about a defense that overachieved all year long and finally got burnt. That's what happened in that fourth quarter. Now, here's where Jason Garrett is going to either make it or break it as the Dallas Cowboys head coach. You know as well as I do that the years on a coach's contract mean nothing, especially to a guy like Jerry Jones that can afford to buy out any contract he divvies out to the head coach. They mean nothing. And if he goes out and they give him the defense he needs to go with his offense and they still don't make it to the Super Bowl, he's going to be on the hot seat.
If Dallas fails to make the playoffs next year, he's gone.
Probably. But here's the thing. I want to see what they do. I want to see their offseason moves. I want to see, because they've got a lot of young players on this roster. They're going to have some cap space for the first time, and I don't know when. The last few years, they've had, $1 million, $2 million in cap space,
right,
and they had to cut 8 players to get that. Okay? They don't have that problem this year. Okay. Now the decision is going to be: do you bring back DeMarco Murray, or do
Better.
You bring in someone, or do you bring someone younger and put all your money on Dez Bryant? Because I'm not necessarily sure they can afford both and still do what they need to do to fix that defense.
Right. I mean, that's the whole thing: is what got you to where you were this year? Was it Dez?
Right.
Was it DeMarco?
Was it DeMarco? Was it the offensive line?
It was DeMarco. Because I'll tell you what. DeMarco is a freak of athletic talent, and if you try to bring him in with somebody different, you're not going to have the same sustainable success with the running game. DeMarco Murray, probably not. What I will say is, you know what? Put your money on the horse. Put your money on the horse that you haven't even ridden until this season.
At this point, I expect Dallas to restructure some contracts. I think Tony Romo's contract needs to be restructured, frankly.
Because if you put the ball in Tony Romo's hands again, all bets are off. That's why he was successful this season, because you had DeMarco Murray taking the load off of him, taking the pressure off his shoulders, and that was how Tony Romo was able to make Dez Bryant even more effective, was the fact that he wasn't throwing the ball 30-plus times a ball game. It was isolated. They used Tony Romo perfectly this year, and if you don't bring back DeMarco Murray and you ask Tony Romo to pass it 40 times a game, that is surefire 8-8 for Dallas.
Of course it is. So let's just speak hypothetically. They bring back both Dez and DeMarco Murray. They go out and they get a pass rusher. It doesn't have to be the top one on the market, which is Sue, but they go out and they get a pass rusher. Then they use their draft. They get guys that can come in. They're going to get Sean Lee back maybe for a game before he hurts himself again next year. That's going to help the linebacker core. You bring in some help in the secondary. all of a sudden, you make that defense at least comparable to the offense, and Dallas is right there at the end of the year where they were this year, but this time they've got the defense that can shut down a Green Bay in the fourth quarter instead of getting rolled over. This was a defensive loss, and that defense finally got burnt for the first time all year long. They got burnt at the wrong possible time. But that's why they lost that football game. I don't think this was on Garrett. It certainly wasn't on Romo. And I don't even think that you could say that DeMarco Murray, because the fumble, if you look at it, Julius Peppers puts his hand right on that football. Every running back in football is going to lose it there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It was a series of unfortunate events in that fourth quarter. Going into the fourth quarter, Dallas looked great. And then the fourth quarter hit, and you had all kinds of things happen to him.
Yep.
The Dez reversal. Peppers putting his hand right on the football, and that kept that defense on the field a lot longer than they had been the previous three quarters when they were having success. So this is a Cowboys team that went way above what I thought they would.
Well, considering a lot of people thought this was going to be one of the worst teams in the league. Yeah.
I was one of them.
Bo, we are up against the wall, so it's time to make our cheers. So what are we drinking tonight?
Jameson. I'm going back to the old original.
The old original, huh? What are you cheering this week?
I am cheering that kid in Ohio State. Third string quarterback. He's played three of the biggest games of any college quarterback's life. Does it his first three games. He runs the table, wins the national championship, and then he owns it with the media and everybody after it, saying, yeah, it's stupid to go to the NFL right now. I'm not ready. I'm cheering that kid, and I'm pulling for him.
I am cheersing with the Deschutes Black Butte Porter. I'm not exactly a dark beer type of guy, but it just happened to be whatever was in our fridge. It is what it is. I guess beggars can't be choosers. So what I will say is I'm cheersing the start of the inevitable baseball season because I can't wait. I am really footballed out. I'm to a point where
Your team is in the NFC Championship.
And you know what? I am so glad I got to work that day. I'm so glad. You know what? What's kind of funny is, to me, it's all about, and I'm sure you've noticed this, for me, as the years go by, the more that it's all about college football. And once that season is over, I am done, Bo. I am done. Done. And I don't care where my pro football team is. They're in the NFC Championship, and I'm like, we're like 3 weeks away from spring training, so there's that, you know? So that's where I'm at, dude. That's where I'm at.
Wow, we really are about 3 weeks away from spring training.
We are. Pitchers and catchers report, I believe, on February 8th.
Nice, yeah.
Right, so we're right there. We are right on the cusp of something good. So, Bo, that's going to do it for us. I'd like to thank everybody who tuned in and everybody who will tune in next week. Until that time, you can check us out on Twitter at InsiderSteve, at LCRReed. Next time, same bat time, same bat channel. So, Bo, take us out. XOXO.